You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Caden tokuingawa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Jasmine. If Akane coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about the Employment Relations Amendment Bill, the National Infrastructure Plan, and the Salvation Army's State of the Nation report. I also spoke to ETU National Secretary Rachel McIntosh and University of Auckland Teaching Fellow Simon Schofield on the impact of the government's Employment Relations Amendment Bill. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Ferry about the presence of politicians at Big Gay Out, tolling a new harbour crossing, local government's value for money committee, and Council's use of AI. I also spoke to Zero Waste Aotearoa's Sue Coots about mining e-waste for minerals instead of fast-tracking new mining shafts.
Hea ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kāua e wari wari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, e pakihiri rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The government's Employment Relations Amendment Bill has passed its third and final reading. The bill has been criticised by the Labour Party, with MP Camilla Balich saying it eroded the rights of employees that the government was alleging to support. The government has revealed the first ever National Infrastructure Plan. The report sets out 16 key recommendations as well as 10 priority areas for the next decade. And the Salvation Army has released its annual State of the Nation report for 2026. The report shows a decrease in victims of violent crime, but an increase in victims of family violence. The latest reporting on child poverty from 2024 also shows the situation has worsened since previous years. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking for his thoughts on the Employment Relations Members Bill.
Well, this bill erodes the rights of workers. It takes New Zealand workers back decades. And, you know, this is an ongoing theme from this government in attacking workers' rights.
Chris Hipkins says this law change would drive workers to Australia. Is that something you agree with?
Well, definitely. If people don't see the rights of workers recognised here in Aotearoa, then they will choose to go somewhere else where they're better looked after, better paid, their conditions are better. And what we're seeing from this government and Christopher Luxon is that they're making workers' rights and conditions worse.
But does there need to be more clarity surrounding who is an employer versus contractor?
No, there doesn't. It's very clear in law of what is a contractor and what is an employee. What this bill does is it erodes the rights of workers to be reflected as so and pushes people to be contractors, which creates less responsibility and obligations on the employer, and that's unfair.
And moving on, are you supportive of the National Infrastructure Plan?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. People will know that New Zealand suffers from an incredible infrastructure deficit. We haven't invested in the way that we've needed to over decades. So as a result, you know, we see below the ground our water infrastructure isn't where it needs to be. And above the ground, our transport infrastructure isn't able to cope with the population growth that we've had. Saying that, there are political choices in there that determines what the priorities are. We've seen this government invest way too heavily in roads and not enough in public transport in Auckland, for example. So those are decisions that have to be ironed out.
Are there any specific recommendations missing that you would have liked to see included?
A larger focus on public transport is incredibly important. We still see large investment in roads. I'm unsure if that's the direction of travel, so to speak, that New Zealand should be going in. We need to be future-focused. Saying that, it is incredibly expensive. The project of the additional harbour crossing, for example, is desperately needed, but that comes with a significant price tag. We've got to ask the question to Aucklanders, how will we pay for that? I'm not so keen on there being two additions of tolls on both bridges, but that's an important conversation that we must have.
The report notes that climate change is one reason that building and maintaining infrastructure is so expensive. Does this point to a need for investment in climate adaptation?
It certainly does. We need to focus on addressing the weather events, looking after communities and protecting infrastructure. As we've seen in recent weeks and over the past couple of years, when weather events hit, they hit hard and they hit fast, and our infrastructure hasn't been able to keep up. So we need to invest up front in future-proofing local infrastructure that cares for our communities.
And I want to ask now about the Salvation Army's State of the Nation report, which shows family violence is at its highest since 2018. How alarming is this to you?
Incredibly alarming. In my community in Auckland's North Shore, we've seen the closure of the North Shore Women's Centre. It was the one provider over there where women could access support during domestic violence. You know, that's incredibly hard that the government have turned their backs on both this, also on addressing homelessness, also addressing some of the needs of children in poverty, which this report explicitly outlines.
On that point, children in material hardship, the number of children in material hardship has increased, with 70,000 of these children being Māori. Why do you think this is?
Well, we've seen this government make big promises around the cost of living. They haven't. In fact, they've made things more expensive, and as a result, it pushes more families, including working families, into poverty. That impacts on our tamariki, on our kids, their ability to go to school, the resources that they need. And this government just doesn't let up. They're not focused on those that need support. They're focused on tobacco companies and landlords.
The Child Poverty Action Group says what is needed to combat poverty is benefit increases. Is this something you can commit to?
We'll outline our policy commitments before the election. But under Labor, we know that we will care for those that are vulnerable. We will focus on supporting children that live in poverty. But we'll also ensure that dignity of these people is upheld. And so, you know, we haven't seen that under this government. And leadership in this country actually needs to represent valuing all New Zealanders, not just those at the top.
A huge driving factor for these levels of poverty is also the increasing levels of unemployment. What would Labor do to increase employment opportunities, particularly for disadvantaged groups?
Absolutely. I've been focused on raising awareness around New Zealand on the government's failure, where we see 90,000 young people not engaged in education, training or employment. This is the size of a city like Tauranga. These young people are being left behind, and they're only one particular group that is suffering the impacts of this government's choices, economic choices, which means that they're out of a job and there's no hope moving forward under Christopher Luxon's leadership.
That was Labor MP Shannon Halbert on the Employment Relations Amendment Bill, the National Infrastructure Plan, and the Salvation Army's State of the Nation report.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Big Gay Out was held by the Burnett Foundation on Sunday, and appearances from some politicians were met with controversy, ending with a protester's removal from the main stage. There have been discussions of a $9 toll to finance a new harbour crossing this week, while Auckland Council's Value for Money Committee has also commenced for 2026. I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about these topics alongside new council initiatives that utilise AI. Big Gay Out was on Sunday, huge celebration, but there was also some unrest during the political segment of the programming. What are your thoughts on the presence of politicians at an event like this?
Well, first to say that I love going to Big Gay Out. My now 10-year-old has really enjoyed it for the last few years, so we always try to go, and we were there this year. I wasn't there when they had the politician segment, and I know that it has become sort of increasingly controversial because we do have politicians at the national level who are making homophobic and transphobic statements, putting in place policies that attack those communities. And so, and of course, Pride has always been political. And so there is this tension there between acknowledging the role that politicians have in making positive change and the politicians who do champion issues for the queer community and indeed maybe queer themselves, a number of queer politicians were on the stage, with the fact that we have other politicians who are not friends to the rainbow issues. So I really feel for the Burnett Foundation actually who organised this, because it's a time that they want to acknowledge, especially in an election year, politicians who do the good stuff and are part of the queer community. They probably also feel they have to give equal space to all the parties, but not all the parties are friendly, and a number of parties in particular in this term, National New Zealand First and ACT, have been supporting really regressive, painful policies like the block on puberty blockers, the ban on puberty blockers for trans youth. So I can understand they need to, as organisers, they want the community to be politically involved, and they want to acknowledge the politics, the politics that affects people's everyday lives, but also there are some politicians who are doing bad stuff. So I think it's okay that those parties were called out on the day. I actually think that's quite a healthy part of democracy. I think for the Burnett Foundation and the organisers, if what they're wanting is something that is purely celebration, I don't know, I'm not part of the community, so it's not my place to say, but maybe those two things don't mix. And so that is a challenge, I think, for the organisers and for the community at large.
And there's been talk of a possibility of a $9 toll introduced to finance a new harbour crossing in Tāmaki. What power would Aucklanders have to weigh in on this decision?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one because it seems to be changing pretty much daily. So we had the National Infrastructure Plan work released by the Infrastructure Commission, which is a nationally focused piece of work. But then alongside that, we also have a whole lot of work that Auckland's doing on its own infrastructure, including in the transport space. And funnily enough, an additional harbour crossing across the Waitemata isn't actually something that politically we've been talking about on Auckland Council. Sometimes government has come to us and said, hey, we're doing work on this and we've given some input, but they largely seem to be progressing without us. And I guess part of that is because it will be NZTA, it will be national infrastructure. But the reality is that the number of vehicles crossing Harbour Bridge peaked some years ago and has been dropping, while the number of people crossing Harbour Bridge has increased significantly because people are shifting mode from private car to bus. And someone pointed out today on the radio, actually people who catch the bus are effectively paying a toll and they don't have a choice to go by bike or walk for free. So, I would prefer that we talked about, well, actually, do we need an additional harbour crossing? What modes would it focus on? And then sort of work backwards from, is this actually a solution we need? And then work out the financing. At the moment, it's looking pretty unaffordable to do a project like this. So should it actually be a priority? And Auckland's about to, Auckland Council, as we take on more responsibility from Auckland Transport, we're about to do a 30-year integrated transport plan for the city, and there will be opportunities to give input on that. But the conversation about, like, tolling the bridge or whatever's going to potentially happen there, there will be opportunities for input if local government has a say, because we have to consult. Central government, not so much. You know, they don't consult on their own budget, for example, whereas we consult excessively on ours, and we'll be doing so from the 27th of February.
And this week, Council's Value for Money Committee has recommenced for 2026. Could you tell us a bit about this ROPU?
Yeah, so I'm actually on this committee. I was on the equivalent committee that had a different name last term as well. And so this is the committee that is really focused on how do we become more efficient as an organisation, how do we make savings. And it's important to note that the word in the title there is value. So it's not necessarily all about cutting costs and saving money. It is actually about what is the best value. So sometimes that might be spending more to get more, not necessarily always spending less to get the same. It's really interesting. We had a session this week on the priorities for the term and possible goals to achieve. There are savings targets that are already in the budget, some of them quite ambitious, saving over $100 million a year in what we spend, which is quite a lot of money. And every year this committee has been overseeing savings, so efficiencies effectively, rather than cuts. But we've done most of the low-hanging fruit in terms of the easy stuff to make efficient, and now we start to, in the coming years, get into the conversations that are potentially more difficult, where people might see change in their community and the way that services are delivered that they may or may not like. And so that's going to be a really interesting challenge over the next this term, is how do we continue to become more efficient without necessarily compromising the services that a lot of people expect to be delivered.
And last month, Council spoke about trialling AI technology to try and reduce recycling errors. What other ways does Council harness AI at the moment? Could you share any?
Yeah, so Council's been working on an AI, I guess, chatbot, which chatbots have a bad rep, but it's being tested sort of in, I don't know if it's called beta testing, I'm not quite sure what phase of the testing it's in at the moment, but in a sort of online assistant called Ask Auckland Council that you can ask for information, and it will be able to trawl through all of the online information that Council has, which is a lot, and direct people to the right stuff. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that works, because as I say, chatbots, I've used them, sometimes when you stay in a hotel, they have the thing and you can ask it questions, and I've found it incredibly frustrating. Or you use a utility provider and it's like, ask our AI assistant, sometimes that works to find information. So that's being actually tested by elected members at the moment. I haven't tried it out myself yet, but they just gave us the code for that on Tuesday. But there's also some other AI stuff that's really interesting, and the recycling one is a type of this, where we're using AI with cameras to pick up stuff that the human eye might miss. And so the ability of AI to process a large amount of visual data and go, hey, there's waste in that recycling bin that is contaminating it. So as opposed to having to manually check that bin, right? So that's the recycling one. But also in a different context, train platforms. So we have cameras focused on all the train platforms, and we now have, AT's been working on AI to go, if an object moves in too close to the edge of the platform, it sets off not an alarm, but it brings that camera to the attention of the human being that's watching the cameras, so they can direct the staff working on the platform to go and go, hey, hang on a second, what's going on here? And, for example, it might be a child that's getting too close to the end, or someone who's been, an adult who's been pushed or whatever. So that's a safety thing. They're looking at similar tech in pools as well, to assist lifeguards where people might be having trouble and they're under the water and hard to see. So there's some quite cool stuff like that. but very mindful of the environmental impacts of AI, looking to do it in ways that are efficient and don't do some of the bad stuff we've seen around data centres and things like that. Yeah.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on politics at Big Gay Out, tolling a new harbour crossing, local government's value for money committee and council's use of AI.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts 5395.
It's all connected.
What's all connected? Where did you get all this string?
Okay, so Tom Scott collaborated with Mara Tike, who worked with Troy Kingi, who had an album produced by Delaney Davidson, who's also worked with Marlon Williams, and...
You've been reading Audio Culture.
Yeah!
Plunge into Aotearoa's musical history with Audio Culture, the number one repository of hard facts, tall tales, insider info, and lovingly researched editorial on NZ music. Audio Culture Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Audioculture.co.nz.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back and faster than ever before. B-Rave, Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95 BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95 BFM, Spades, Kira Huketsu, and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Science. Yep, it's all around us. A rock. That's science. Sandals. That's science too. My wife calling me to tell me to pick up some milk. You'd never know it, but that's science too. But where and what day do we go to find out about more science?
Dear Science, join the Tuesday Wire team as they speak to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs chatting about discoveries, controversies and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
tūra tū kiriko ko taku whirika kia mato hā nei au tako hia tūra tū kiriko ko taku whirika kia mato hā nei au ara he kawa I tētahi rā he reka rawa atu I tētahi atu rā koirā te mate ki tēnā tūroro whai take aro kore karoko a me whai te tika ka whaka kone kone he arero kare ao ka whati e ka rito arero kaore e whati aere tonu ana e kati he arero kare ao ka whati e ka rito arero kaore e whati haere tonu ana e kati
hoke atu o ki taku to e whenua tērā taku kai katoa
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
The government's Employment Relations Amendment Bill has passed its third and final reading. The bill has been spearheaded by Employment Relations Minister Brooke Van Velden. Two key parts of the bill are a new test to decide whether workers are considered employees or contractors and an income threshold of $200,000 above which workers can no longer bring personal grievances for unjustified dismissal. The bill has been highly controversial, with Labour leader Chris Hipkins saying the law change would drive workers to Australia and that Van Velden doesn't understand the dynamic that exists between an employer and an employee. Green MP Tiano Tuiono also called it a terrible bill and a dark day for workers in Aotearoa. I spoke to ETU National Secretary Rachel McIntosh about what the bill means for workers, particularly the new test to define who is a contractor. I started by asking if she could go through her key concerns for the bill.
It is a real attack on the ability for working people to get decent work is kind of the big picture, and it does this in multiple ways. What the minister says is that it is rebalancing things to give employers more power. In fact, it gives employers who already have more power than the people they employ much, much more power. It allows employers to label workers as contractors without regard to the real nature of what's going on in the relationship. And the effect of that on a working person is that they have to pay their own taxes, they have no right to sick leave or annual leave, they basically have no employment rights because suddenly 150 years of fighting to give people basic rights so that they have some security in their jobs is just wiped away. That's the really big one. It also makes it much harder for a worker if an employer sacks them unjustifiably or in fact does something else to disadvantage them unjustifiably. The law has changed so that it is much easier for employers to do that, so that if you challenge it, even if you win, you're very unlikely to get your job back. You won't get your job back. And also, if you've contributed in any way, that's the legal word is contribution. Like if the reason they sacked you is because you were doing something they didn't like, then that counts as contribution. Then you get no compensation, which just makes it way more likely that employers will sack people without worrying about whether they're doing it right or not.
What is your response to Brooke Van Velden's specific comment that this bill is about increasing confidence for businesses, especially when taking a risk on a new hire?
what we know from experience is that if you make it, if you do this and you make that kind of statement, it makes no difference to how many people get jobs. It's the same thing that people with Brooke Van Velden's worldview say about increasing wages. They say if you have really low wages, people are more likely to get jobs. If you have really low job security, people are more likely to get jobs. Well, there's two things. One, evidence shows that that doesn't work. People are not more likely to get jobs. And two, that that just lowers the quality of the work that people will get because it won't be adequately paid. They won't have adequate security.
And I want to ask, is this legislation essentially a response to the Supreme Court rejecting Uber's appeal against treating drivers like employees?
The part about contractors lines up exactly with what Uber wanted and with what Uber was arguing in court that they wanted the answer to be. They didn't get that answer in court, and now this legislation basically gives Uber everything that they wanted.
So is this about the government caving to the demands of this kind of big multinational?
Well, certainly that's what it looks like. Brooke Van Velden denies it. I do like to believe people when they say things, but sometimes it's really hard to believe it because the coincidence of this law and what Uber wanted is just so remarkable.
And do you agree with the opposition's criticisms of the bill, particularly what we've heard from Labor and the Greens?
Yes, absolutely. So Labor and the Greens both see the value of work and they see the value of working people having decent work, including the ability to organise collectively and join a union.
Is there anything else you would want people to know about this bill?
This takes us back decades, if not centuries, to a time when work was really precarious, where employers held all the power and workers just had to basically compete with each other for scraps and as contractors charge the lowest amount possible for their labour. And we need wages to grow. So it does the opposite of what is needed by people in this country.
I also spoke to University of Auckland Law School Professional Teaching Fellow Simon Schofield about the bill, particularly the impact on those earning more than $200,000 and workers more generally. I started by asking if he could explain the new employment rules for people earning more than $200,000.
So the Employment Relations Amendment bill that is soon to be an act means that people over $200,000 or earning more than $200,000 per year are unable to pursue a personal grievance for unjustified dismissals. Now, there is a time lag involved in those rules, which mean that for the next 12 months that the parties can negotiate to contract back into the personal grievance provision.
What is the alternative process proposed in the bill and why don't you think it will work as well?
The way in which the bill is set up is to create this situation where you have at-will termination for those earning over $200,000. The problem is that until the economic disadvantage of being terminated is taken away, i.e. There's some sort of requirement for unemployment insurance or income protection insurance, it means that those senior level employees will inevitably, once they're terminated, will be unable to pay the bills, right? And so by having the current system where everything is determined whether there's a unjustified dismissal and in particular where a fair and reasonable process has been undertaken and there's a good reason for the termination, that serves as a mitigating factor to prevent those employees having issues with that termination. So the suggestion, the way in which the bill is set up is that those employees can be terminated at a moment's notice, and obviously that creates will create conflict.
How does this compare to other countries we generally compare ourselves to on employment law, places like Australia, for example?
Yeah, so it's interesting you mention Australia. So Australia has had an income threshold for personal grievances for a number of years under the Fair Work Act. The differences between the New Zealand system and the Australian system is that, for instance, collective agreements, enterprise agreements they call them over in Australia, they mean that certain categories of workers are exempt from that income threshold. So when we talk about pilots and we talk about doctors, in Australia, they're automatically entitled to the unjustified dismissal protection, but in New Zealand, they won't be. That creates, they may or may not be, depending on what the negotiations that take place in the 12-month period. So there are a number of advantages in the Australian system which haven't been reflected in the bill.
The bill introduces a number of new changes. Is there anything else you think is worth highlighting?
Well, there's two. The two big changes are the specified contractor exemption. So basically those working in the gig economy and couriers will no longer be able to allege that they're an employee because of the specific exemption that's provided. They're provided, of course, that they fall within the wording of the specified contractor exemption. In relation to dismissals where an employee has contributed to the dismissal, then there are various changes which mean that those employees aren't entitled to remedies. In particular, remedies of reinstatement and compensation for humiliation, loss of dignity and injury to feelings. Just related to that is that previously an employee who contributed to dismissal, the general rule was that that could be up to 50%. The remedies could be reduced. Another change is implemented in the bill is that that is now at 100%. So employees' remedies can be reduced entirely. In addition to that, the obstruction that an employee imposes on an employer during a disciplinary process or employment process will be taken into account in assessing the justification for the dismissal.
And is there anything else you think people should know about this piece of legislation, especially the kind of impact it could have moving forward?
Yeah, the answer to that is there is going to be an impact, but we're not entirely sure on all of the permutations in relation to that. So we know, for instance, that certainly in the high income space, that inherently is going to create a high turnover of staff, which means that that can have a flow-on effect to those middle managers that are trying to deal with the situation. So it can create a lot of uncertainty in workplaces. But in terms of the specified contractor exemption, we'll probably see a lot more young people being treated as specified contractors and not subject to employment protections. In terms of the contribution issue, we may see employers increasingly take a more aggressive approach to dismissals where serious misconduct is alleged, with the result that they may find themselves in problems later down the track. Both the employer and the employee will have difficult questions arising in relation to that serious misconduct.
That was ETU National Secretary Rachel McIntosh and University of Auckland Teaching Fellow Simon Schofield on the impact of the government's Employment Relations Amendment Bill.
Well, if you want to save money in health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is Time Will Tell from Blood Orange. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts, 5395.
Perfect time. Oh, and it keeps Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
A fast-track consent is currently being sought for a major gold mine in Cromwell, Central Otago. This follows the approval of a controversial $8 billion mine that received fast-track approval for the Coromandel in December. Local response has largely presented environmental concerns and raised questions of alternative initiatives for mineral mining in Aotearoa. I spoke to Sue Coutts, Director of External Affairs at Zero Waste Aotearoa, about the potential of e-waste for mining gold and other materials.
Kia ora, Sue. Could you tell us about the potential of gold and mineral mining from e-waste?
Yeah, well, at the moment in New Zealand, we end up with about 99,000 tonnes of e-waste each year, and we're only recycling about 2 tonnes of that, 2% of that, about 2,000 tonnes. So we really need to think about, when we're thinking about how to get access to gold, silver, palladium, copper, platinum, all the different metals that we're using in our electronics, there's a massive pile of them in our e-waste that we should be tapping into before we start thinking about doing something which is quite environmentally, you know, has the potential to damage our environment, like mining. If you think about your electronics, then something like the circuit boards has a lot of gold and silver. The cords and cables have a lot of copper. And so if we could set up a good system for collecting all of that, getting it to someone who can extract those metals back out and recycle them, then that's a much better way for us to go about keeping a more circular economy for metals, you know, those critical metals that we need for our electronic gadgets.
And what could possibly be deterring government focus from this e-waste initiative?
Well, I think what we've seen with government over the last 3 years in particular, that any sort of environmental initiative is not really a priority. You know, the idea is to get the economy cranked up and then we'll worry about the environment. And I think they're really missing the connections between doing the right thing for the environment and doing the right thing for the economy. We know that we could have a really good clean green industry in recycling these metals and, you know, doing a great job with, you know, not only e-waste, but all sorts of other materials that we've got coming through the system. Got companies, you know, really innovative companies in New Zealand who started up their processes and have gone offshore because we just don't have a good system for harvesting the e-waste in New Zealand and collecting it all up and getting it to the processing facilities. So a company like Mint Innovation has gone over to Australia where they do have what we call an e-waste product stewardship scheme. That means that right across the country there's good drop-off points for people and businesses to take their used e-waste and to get it back to the manufacturers. So they're putting $60 million into the Australian economy instead of doing all that work and creating those jobs here in New Zealand.
What kind of legislative commitment would you want to see to best utilise our e-waste going forward?
Well, what we had was, about 6 years ago, Eugenie Sage declared a number of products priority products, and she said they were problems, you know, basically they were problems that needed to be solved in New Zealand. So e-waste was one of those products, actually, that the government decided at the time what needed a product stewardship scheme. So a product stewardship scheme is really the government sets up the legislation and the regulation that says anyone who puts these kinds of products, say electronic waste could be anything from phones or laptops, it could be any kind of electronic gadgets like TVs or toys or tools, anything with electronic componentry in it. Anyone who puts those kinds of things in the market, they have to be part of a scheme to get back those products at the end of their life. And we really have seen very little progress with that. As you might have heard, you know, the Ministry for the Environment is the bill to disestablish that is going into the House today. We've had very little, Ministry for the Environment over the last 3 years has been really defunded. You know, it's been not much money has gone into resourcing this kind of work. And all of the good work that was done by the ministry, you know, from 2000 till about 2023, is just sitting on the shelf. Nothing really is happening with that. So we would love to see the government pick this up, go, okay, how do we make getting a good recycling and reuse industry going in New Zealand part of our economic development strategy? How do we, we need to put in place the new waste legislation, which has been sitting on the shelf for 6 years as well. A few opportunities to put in feedback, but we really haven't seen that come into the House to the Select Committee. We need to get that new legislation so that we have the right tools to be able to run good product stewardship schemes in New Zealand. none of those tools are, you know, are known. You know, there's good schemes all around the world that we can look to get the models. So we really need government to pass that legislation, and then we need them to prioritise investing and setting up the regulations we need for it to work. And then after that, the scheme pays for itself, because the charges that are required to cover the real cost of recycling would be included in the purchase price. So you'd pay at the beginning, so when you buy your phone, you'd pay, you know, a dollar or so to help cover the cost of that being properly recycled at the end of its life.
And how can communities take the lead on ensuring more effective circularity of e-waste until we can see these changes be put in place?
Well, I think one thing that people can do is just keep on making noise about wanting to have these services. You know, the customer is always right. We know that for the companies that put these products on the market, they really care about what their customers think. So just make sure you keep letting them know that that is what you'd like to do if you're, you know, a person out there. The best thing you can do is to keep using your gadgets for as long as possible. So if you've bought your phone, keep using it for a few years. You know, make the most use you can out of the resources and the energy that are embodied in that product. And if you do find that it's no longer functional for you and not doing what you need it to, then think about using, you know, getting a second-hand one or a refurbished one if you possibly can, because that makes use of resources that are already in the economy rather than pulling new materials out of our environment to make you a new phone or a new laptop. And then if you do have a gadget that, you know, has come to the end of its life, it's no longer useful for you, then make sure that you drop it off at an e-waste recycler or someone like that, and especially if it's got a battery in it, because you would have heard on the news, and most people would have heard on the news, that a lot of the lithium batteries, etc., are really risky for fires. So we're seeing fires in rubbish trucks, we're seeing fires at recycling centres, fires at landfills. And that these are being, a lot of them being caused by lithium batteries that get damaged and then spark and start a fire. So there's sort of that, you know, the fire risk with the batteries, as well as the, you know, that real lost opportunity to harvest metals from our e-waste rather than getting them from our national parks or beautiful landscapes. The better if we don't have to start any new mines and we can just make use of all these metals that are already floating around in our economy.
And is there anything else you would like to share with us today?
Well, I think that the you know, that idea of circular economy is a really powerful idea. It's a bit out of fashion in New Zealand at the moment, but all around the world we're seeing, you know, Australia, Europe, people all around the world are really working hard to get these product stewardship schemes up and running and to get them working well. They can be a real positive because they create jobs and they do set us up with good, clean, green industries for the future. And in New Zealand, that's an important thing at the moment. You know, we're seeing quite high unemployment rates and people, you know, keen to get jobs and in industries which are positive, forward-looking. You know, I feel as though it'd be a much more satisfying job to be working in a facility pulling gold out of circuit boards than it would be to be, you know, stripping it out of the earth. We know that the concentrations in e-waste are much higher. You know, you have to mine a lot of tons of ore to get, you know, a few grams of gold, whereas in our circuit boards, it's quite high concentrations already of gold in there. So, yeah, it makes a lot more sense.
That was Sue Coutts, Director of External Affairs at Zero Waste Aotearoa, on the potential of circular economy through mining e-waste in comparison to fast-tracking new mine shafts.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, E2's Rachel McIntosh, University of Auckland's Simon Schofield, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, and Zero Waste Aotearoa's Sue Coutts. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.